This is Digital Story Podcast number 560, November 29th, 2016. Today's theme is Thoughts from Seven Conservation Photographers. I'm Derek Story. On November 15th and 16th, I spent 2 days in the company of some of the best conservation photographers in the world. During that time, I photographed them, recorded segments from their talks, and even sat down for an interview at the Carnegie Institute for Science in Washington, D.C. And today, I'm going to share highlights from those 2 days with you, so you too can be a part of this amazing conference called WildSpeak 2016. This show is supported in part by Mindshift Gear, who proudly sponsors the ILCP in their mission to protect our planet and its resources through photography. Additional funding was contributed by Red River Paper, who supports the digital story from California to the East Coast and everywhere in between. And special thanks to the members of our inner circle who have pledged through Patreon, enabling me to bring shows like this to all of our listeners. So this is going to be a terrific show, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did putting it together. So basically, I have seven photographers whom I listened to and looked at their pictures and interacted with at WildSpeak, which is a conference put on annually by the International League of Conservation Photographers. The photographers that you're going to hear from today are Steve Winter, Amy Glulick, Chris Linder, Daniel Beltra, Brian Skiri, Sandeesh Kadur, and Robin Moore. All of these photographers have much to contribute. So what I did was, while they were talking, I recorded segments of their talk, and then I've, you know, kind of edited things, you know, trimmed, you know, to the left, to the right, all that. I haven't really edited anything that they said. All I did was trim around the parts that I wanted to present to you. And that's what I have for you today. So the way that we're going to do this is I'm going to start out with Steve Winter, and we'll hear from him, and then we'll listen to Amy and Chris. Then we'll have the interview with Danielle. Then we'll hear from Brian, Sandeesh, and wrap up with Robin. Now, after Robin says his piece, which I think is a great piece for closing out this show, I'm just going to fade to music at that point. You won't hear from me anymore because I want to let his words stay with you. And I think his words this week are far more important than anything that I could say as an add-on. So let's start out by hearing from Steve Winter. Steve had the keynote from day one, and it was called Big Cats. And he's known for his amazing wildlife photography, and especially that of big cats. Steve Winters feels a great responsibility not only to show and excite readers about the natural world, but also about its fascinating people and cultures as well. He wants to give people a reason to care. In his keynote talk, Steve discusses how he, as a photographer, is working to help to save big cats all over the world.
It was on the Resplendent Quetzal. And every day I would sit in a plastic chair in a blind in which I made myself, all day long with a long lens trained on a nest. Someday I would get one picture, someday maybe get a couple, and someday no images at all. And many days when I was walking back to the one-room shack on top of the mountain in the cloud forest in Guatemala, all the hair on the back of my hair would stand up and on my arms, and I felt that something was watching, following me. I would turn around, there's nothing there. And one night I'm all alone in the bunk, read my book like I do every night, when all of a sudden I heard the stairs creaking. Then I heard the floorboards creaking. Then I heard scratching under the door and then sniffing. All the hair on my whole body stood up. And I grabbed the trusty machete which I had next to the bed. It was my first natural history story. It was going to protect me. I whacked it on the side of the bunk. Silence. Then for some unknown reason, I whistled. And I heard front paws, back paws going down the stairs. I grabbed a walkie-talkie to call Juan Carlos, the naturalist I was working with. And in Spanish, I told him what happened. And he was in the local cantina with the button on the walkie-talkie pushed. All I heard was a bunch of laughing. And he said, Esteban, no problema. It's just a black panther. Now, I was a little upset because I'd been there for 5 weeks and I had to ask him the next day, why did you never tell me that I was living with a black panther? And I think that was the night that the cats chose me. That cat came by 3 weeks later, and luckily that was the same day I got the last picture I needed, and I left. Now, if anybody would have told me my next story would have been jaguars, I would have told them they were crazy because I didn't know anything about big cats. But there was this new thing called the internet, and I saw this picture on there. It was this image next to this man who photographed it. It was the first picture of a jaguar in the United States. So like we do with every idea that we have at National Geographic, we write up a proposal. So I started doing research, found out National Geographic had never done a story on the jaguar before. And my wife, journalist Sharon Gynups, who's in the crowd, said to me, don't you figure if in 107 years National Geographic has never done a story on the world's third largest cat, that there's a pretty good reason why? She's the smarter of the bunch. And the answer is because it's too difficult. They're very secretive. Jaguar is found from the U.S.-Mexican border all the way to northern Argentina. And I started the story in the Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica because National Geographic had a grantee that we were funding that was capturing and radio collaring jaguars as they roamed the beach looking for marine turtles. But when I got to Costa Rica, so did El Nino. The water got too hot, the turtles disappeared, as did the jaguars, and I thought my newfound career as a wildlife photographer was soon going to be over. Now, the only way that you could photograph jaguars back then was to use a remote camera. I didn't know anything about remote cameras or camera traps. They were only primarily used by scientists or a couple photographers. I'll never forget when I asked Nick Nichols for advice. The one thing Nick said was, you're gonna think you got something, but you don't. I said, thanks, Nick. But I actually ended up in 2.5 months getting 2 images. This was one of them. So I knew I had to go actually find these animals and see them face to face. But before I did it, I was thinking about Nick's picture of a tiger in the car going down the Las Vegas Strip, and I'd heard about an animal rehab center in Cancun, so I thought, let me go try to get a picture of one of these cats that used to be a pet. So I went to Cancun on my way to Brazil, where I was going to go, and got a picture I didn't know I wanted of a jaguar with jets. But I needed to go to see these cats, like I said, face to face. And I got contacted by a scientist in Brazil. So I went to the Pantanal. He was the first guy ever studying jaguars down there, Ricardo Bulhosa. But I had to put my photojournalism hat back on because I found out that 95% of the Pantanal is privately owned. And every cowboy hated jaguars. They felt that every dead cow was the fault of a jaguar. So I met another scientist, and through my relationship with Dr. Alma Rabinowitz, got her funded with GPS sat collars to try to answer these ranchers' questions. Because we saw things like this, which was that cowboy in the background killed that cat because he said it was a cattle killer. Now, I was also given a box of 12 skulls and said, you've got 24 hours to make a picture out of this. But my desire was to find out with this project whether it was true. You know, jaguar is responsible for most cattle deaths. When the project was finished, we found that it was 1.5% of cattle deaths could be attributed to jaguars. So that was great, and ranchers started to believe it.
Now I have Amy Gulick for you, and she is the author of Salmon in the Trees. And you know, You may wonder, well, where does the title Salmon in the Trees come from? Well, it's actually something that happens every day during salmon season, where the bears catch a salmon, and since they don't like sharing with other bears, they'll climb up in a tree and eat the salmon. And you can actually see photographs of Amy's of bears sitting in trees eating salmon. And that's where the title comes from. Now, this area that she talks about, the Tongass Rainforest, is home to abundance of bears, bald eagles, and salmon. The National Forest in Alaska contains one-third of the world's rare old-growth coastal temperate rainforest. Amy Gulick has been working in the region for years, and her book on this work, Salmon in the Trees, Life in Alaska's Tongass Rainforest, is a recipient of an independent publisher book award. So we have two parts from Amy. The first part is earlier in her talk, where she's talking a little bit about the situation and, you know, what attracted her to this type of photography. And then the second part is actually a question from someone in the audience, which I think you'll find interesting. So here's Amy Gulick.
So I worked on various conservation campaigns, all with an emphasis on preserving wild lands. Much of that is public land, meaning it belongs to every single one of us in this room and every single American. And most of that, my work takes place in Alaska. And my recent and ongoing work, Salmon in the Trees, has at its core one goal, and that's to preserve the ecological integrity of one of the rarest temperate rainforests remaining on the planet. This is the Tongass National Forest of Alaska. Now, before I share with you this incredible part of the world, I want you to know something about me. You already know what I am, thanks to John's intro, but I really want you to know who I am. I really appreciate that Robin shared a little bit of who he is as well. So people often ask me, how did you become a conservation photographer? Well, this is how it started. As a kid, I had a fascination with animals, particularly wild animals and the places where they lived, and also the people who lived near them in places like forests and deserts and coastal areas. And I also had a fascination with storytelling. I published my first story at age 6. I used my maiden name at the time. But words weren't enough. I quickly figured that out. And as soon as I could, the camera became my tool of choice to illustrate my stories over the next several decades. And it has obviously continued to be my tool of choice. But what really drives who I am, and I'm guessing that I share this trait with some of you in this room, I was born with an activist personality, something I really didn't have a say over, just kind of how I came out. I published my first letter to the editor at age 9, and here I am in 1999, dressed as a sea turtle, protesting the World Trade Organization in Seattle. So it's not a stretch to see why I am a conservation photographer. My passions for wild country and storytelling, together with my personality, pretty much ensured that I really couldn't be anything else. And that's how I came to be here, in one of the 5,000 salmon spawning streams found in the Tongass National Forest of Alaska. So I came to the Tongass to tell a new story of this place, a place where the old story, one of industrial scale, clear-cut logging of old-growth forest, and bitter battles had persisted for decades. And when I got involved, a new chapter was about to be written for the Tongass, and yet it was not clear what direction it was going to take. Would we continue unsustainable clear-cut logging of old growth, or would we figure out a way to maintain the still intact ecosystem of this magnificent forest? The Tongass desperately needed and deserved a new story, one that would unite rather than divide, one that would endear rather than turn off, and one that would inspire rather than enrage. Not an easy story to craft, given its history. But I came here because this is a place where there are salmon in the trees. And I knew that if I could help people understand this remarkable phenomenon, they would view the Tongass through new eyes.
You mentioned alienation. I was kind of wondering if you could speak to not just exposing people that haven't experienced this place and understood the connection, but people who were actually sort of diametrically opposed at this point. I mean, some of my family members would see a few minutes of this talk and disregard you as being a hippie or something like that, you know, and they wouldn't be shy about telling you that. And I don't know, it's an appropriate time to start thinking about how do you actually speak to those people as well and engage them.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I will say when we did that traveling tour throughout Southeast Alaska, and I was giving talks to, you know, as they say, I was in the belly of the beast. I was terrified. Yeah, I mean, absolutely terrified to stand up. You know, we're with people whose entire livelihood had completely disappeared, you know, and that was timber at the time. But so what I this was a much shorter version, again, very distilled version and geared towards you as well. When I get up and give my full presentation in communities like that, it's kind of a little bit different of a story, much more people-centric, and really focusing on how people live in this area and what this area means to people. And you know, you never know how it's going to go over, right? But I find, again, if you're not strident, you know, you don't come in with an agenda. And I always say that, you know, our job as photographers to tell this story, I almost say that, we do. I think we have an easier job. If we're coming in and celebrating a place and talking about what makes it so incredible and unique, you know, kind of like Robin was doing with Haiti, and many of you are doing with your projects as well. And my overall message is always, you know, to the local people, it's like, you live in an incredible part of the world, which allows you to live an incredible way of life, which basically makes you incredible people. Who in the audience is going to raise their hand and say, I disagree with you, you hippie? You know, I never, ever, ever had that. And granted, never know who is in your audience. And but one quick story. In one of the probably most conservative communities that I gave a talk in that was hit very hard by the decline of the timber industry, I actually had people come up to me, and I didn't know who they were. And they were thanking me and smiling and buying books. And later, someone came up to me who knew who those people were and said, First of all, I can't believe those people came to this presentation at all. And I really can't believe that they were so excited by it and by your book. But what we really found in this project was what we were doing, and maybe I didn't really even intentionally or consciously realize what I was doing. I was instilling pride in people and their way of life and their home. And who doesn't like that? I mean, I love that, you know, when my hometown pride kicks in. And you never really know what's going to trigger that in people. But that somehow, good, I didn't know, really wasn't intentional. That's what happened with the story. So I think not to alienate people, you just can't be strident, and you can't preach, and you can't tell them how they are supposed to live.
We're now going to hear from Chris Linder, and his talk is called The Big Thaw. And in a lot of ways, this was one of the hardest talks for me to listen to over the course of the 2 days, just because the scientific data he covers about what's going on as parts of the Arctic begin to thaw is very sobering. And, you know, he outlines it pretty well, and he doesn't sugarcoat it. And I think it's something that we need to know. Now, what he wrote about this here is due to rising temperatures in the Arctic, soil that had been locked in the permafrost freezer is now thawing, releasing carbon back to the ecosystem. There, hungry microbes devour it, releasing carbon dioxide and methane gases. These potent greenhouse gases, added to the levels already in the atmosphere, fuel a dangerous feedback cycle. The massive amount of carbon stored in the Arctic permafrost soil, 4 times more than all the vegetation on Earth, has been described as a carbon bomb. Chris has been working on this project since 2009 with the Woods Hole Research Center, creating a series of multimedia videos, interactive website with hundreds of blog posts written by scientists and students, and a forthcoming media campaign in collaboration with the Braided River Press, centered around a hard-covered book and exhibit. And I'm going to let Chris take it from here. Like I said, one of the more sobering messages from the conference, but I think one that we need to hear.
Is that this is the oldest carbon that's ever been measured. right from this exposure. 20,000-year-old carbon is coming out of this exposure, and it's going into the water. And basically what it makes is this kind of permafrost tea. And it's that's basically what the water is there, is it's permafrost tea. And so what's important about that, or what's interesting about that, is what happens to it once it gets into the modern cycle. So I compared this permafrost earlier to meat in a freezer. So if you take this meat out of the 20,000-year-old freezer, and you thaw it, and you eat it, remarkably, it's still good. And so this was one of the, that's a very simplistic way of describing some of the research that's been done there, is to determine if this old carbon still is yummy to microbes. Because what happens is microbes eat, they munch the carbon, and they exhale. Okay, so they make two things. They make it in a dry environment, they make CO2. If they make it in a wet environment, they make methane. Okay? Are either of those really awesome for the climate? No, not really. I think everybody knows that. I don't have to get into why that's bad. Maybe because as the environment warms, this is going to lead to a feedback cycle, where if you have more carbon entering the modern environment, it's munched on, it's respirated, becomes this. Okay, so this is kind of a what scientists are really interested in is this tipping point. And this is, I'm talking about a lot of carbon here. I didn't mention this number before. But if you take all the carbon that's in these permafrost cells, 1.5 trillion tons. Okay, so that's an abstract number. You're like, well, what's that? Or whatever. If you take all that carbon, that's basically twice what's in the atmosphere right now. It's three times what's in the standing stock of above ground forests right now. So if you take all the carbon that's in all the vegetation and all the forests on Earth, triple that, that's what's in the ground. Okay, is all this going to happen overnight? No, of course not. It's not going to convert the gas and flash into a giant explosion and we all get incinerated overnight. Certainly not going to happen at that rate. But this is a sobering thought. None of this research and none of these numbers are in the IPCC climate models for warming temperatures going out into the future. So this process, and a paper came out in Nature in 2015 trying to estimate, put some numbers on this, and this is really a big part of the research, is putting numbers on this. They think that it's going to be, on average, coming to about the equivalent of what the U.S.'s emissions are, carbon emissions are, every year. So every year, it's like another United States, and another United States, and another United States, every year until 2100, and that's not in the models. Okay? Anybody want tissue? Okay, so are there any solutions in the Arctic? Unfortunately, the Arctic, you know, they're not responsible for this. Okay, there's very few emitters in the Arctic. But Sergei has his own plan, is to populate the Arctic with mega herbivores and bring back the tundra steppe. And this would work if he had a billion mega herbivores to make this work. So he's created this area called Pleistocene Park. He's used these mega herbivores to recreate this tundra steppe grasslands environment. Grasslands are great for permafrost. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so I don't want to get into that, but you can ask me later about the Pleistocene Park experiment. But he's doing this on a small scale, but in order for this to really scale up, of course, you need a huge amount of these herbivores to make this work. But the tundra steppe would do it. So where are the solutions to this? You know, one of the solutions is this. Forests, okay, they take up CO2. We need more of this and less of that, okay, because this is what's actually going to take up that CO2, okay, forests. So is there any hope? I mean, I it's hard to put a positive spin on a lot of this because it is pretty sobering. This is one of my biggest takeaways, and one of the things that does make me really excited and hopeful. Every time I've gone in the field, you know, on this project, I've gone in with, you know, and interviewed these young kids. And they're 18 to 22 years old. You know, many of them, it's certainly their first time in the Arctic. You know, and this is Blaze. You know, I photographed her in 2009 and 2010. She came back. Turns out, of the, 69 or so students that have gone through this program, 41 of them have gone on to do graduate work in Arctic studies. 41 out of 69. They published over two dozen normally, undergraduates don't present topics at American Geophysical Union meetings. Okay, it's advanced scientists. So what Max has done and his team of scientists, they've taken these kids, they exposed them to this amazing environment. It's a hard place to work, okay, with the bugs, okay, with being away from family for a month, sometimes brutal heat, it can snow the next day. They fall in love with it. Okay? If you bring people to these places, they are just hooked. You know, Blaise is getting her PhD now in Sweden. We still keep in touch. I mean, she's an amazing person, went to Clark University in Massachusetts, and now she's going to be this big-time famous climate science researcher. I'll be proud to know her and proud to be a little part of her story as she you know, moves on in her career. For me, this gives me a lot of hope. We have, you know, the next generation of scientists that are here. They're passionate, and it's I feel privileged, a great privilege, to be able to help tell their stories. So that's my story.
Now I have a treat for you. We're going to do an interview. We're actually going to sit down with Daniel Beltra. He was born in Madrid, Spain, and you'll be able to tell that by listening to him. And he's a photographer based in Seattle, Washington. Now, his passion for conservation has been evident in the images of our environment that are really poignant. The most striking large-scale photographs by Beltra are images shot from the air. This perspective gives the viewer a wider context to the beauty and destruction he witnesses, as well as revealing the delicate sense of scale. After 2 months of photographing Deepwater Horizon Gulf oil spill, he produced many visually arresting images of the man-made disaster. Now, Danielle's also one of the founders of Mindshift Gear, which is the outdoor bag company associated with Think Tank Photo. And I think the story on how he got involved with them is also very interesting. So we're going to cover that. We're going to cover a little bit about his photography. It's a pretty cool interview. So we'll sit back and listen to that for a bit. And then when we come back, we'll have excerpts from more photographers from the Wild Speak Conference. But right now, here's Danielle. I'm here with Daniel Beltra. I'm really glad that we're sitting down here and talking because there's a couple reasons. One is you definitely have had some involvement with ILCP. You're a photographer that does interesting things. You're going to one place that I'm very interested in. We're going to talk about that in a second. And then I think you were one of the guys that helped start Mindshift Gear, or you were part of that movement. So maybe you could just give us just a little bit of background before I start firing questions at you.
Well, hi, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm originally from Spain. That's where my funny accent comes from. I've been living in Seattle for a decade and a half already. And well, we're here during Wild Speak at the ILCP, the International League of Conservation Photographers, where I'm a fellow. It's a group of like-minded photographers that have a lot of work to do, especially after the result of the coming election. So we're going to be all pretty busy. And it's exciting and humbling and inspiring to be here.
So how would you characterize your photography? You know, and I know that's always kind of a hard question to ask photographers because a lot of times we don't like to be pigeonholed, but just in broad brush strokes, how do you characterize your photography?
Well, interestingly, I've had a very broad approach to photography, and I started as a photojournalist, not really doing any stories on environment. Then that my love for nature really led to being involved with Greenpeace, the environmental group, and I did a lot of work for over 2 decades with them all over the world. So that was more like a documentary kind of work. At the same time, I was photographing for a French agency called Gamma. I was the correspondent in Spain for many years. And then when I moved to the States, it was really all about environmental stories, conservation stories, which are the dearest to me. And little by little, in the last years, my work is really going into the art world. So it's difficult to put me a label right now, but I guess, you know, the work, hopefully the work speaks for itself.
Well, and at the end of the day, of course, that's the most important thing, is the work itself. How did you get involved with ILCP? We should touch on that since we're here at the conference. How did they get on your radar?
Well, interestingly, very early on when the organization started, I contacted a photographer to see if I could fit, and I got a very short reply saying it only works by invitation, and that was it. And a year later, the ILCP called me and said, we'd love to have you on board. So definitely, that's how it started, yeah.
So here comes your invitation, right?
I don't think they were really related. I don't think both cases were related.
No. Okay, okay. So I know you've had a little bit of a layoff. You had your shoulder worked on, didn't you?
Yeah, I had last year was a down year for me. I had rotator cuff surgery on both shoulders. Mm-hmm. So it took a whole year to recover. But I'm happy. It's all working well, and I'm happy to be back on track. Mm-hmm.
Now, is that photography related? Is there something we should know about the dangers of photography?
Well, definitely you want to be careful how you carry your gear and how much weight you carry around. But I don't think it was fully photography related.
Okay. So you and I were talking earlier at break, and you had mentioned that one of the projects on your radar that you'd like to do is related to Greenland, which I found really interesting because I was just in Iceland for the second time. And always when I'm in Iceland, there's talk about Greenland, saying, well, you know, there's some shots there you might be interested in. And it's never really pulled to me. So I'm really curious to hear what's attracting you and what you might want to do with this project that you're thinking about.
Well, I've been in Greenland already, and I went there a couple of years ago. I was always very interested in what global warming is doing to Greenland, and it's a bit the canary in the coal mine. No, Greenland is huge. There's a lot of ice on it, and it's starting to melt and melt very rapidly. So what you can think of as a white landscape of snow and ice, it's really, especially at the end of the summer, is a landscape marred with blue, with rivers, with lakes, with a lot of dark snow, they call it, which is a mixture of pollution, of some algae that creates cryoconite, and so all that lowers the albedo, the reflectivity of the ice, and makes Greenland melt, and it's melting incredibly fast. And I was reading an article very recently. The New Yorker published a story by Elizabeth Colbert with a double spread opening with one of my pictures, and she was talking about in the last 4 years, there's 400 million Olympic pools of water have melted into the ocean from Greenland. It's the figures are incredible. No, so I think it's something that's very important, and we need to pay attention to it. No?
So then are you thinking of going there and documenting this process that's going on?
Yeah, I mostly will be working from the air, which is what I've done a bit already. The landscapes are really, it's a bit of a contradiction. They're beautiful and striking, and at the same time, they're depicting a horrible problem we're having.
Yeah, so that's one of the things about your work that is interesting, actually. And a number of people have commented to me about this, including Alex. And I agree, where when you first look at the image, one of your images, especially from the air, it's very beautiful, very artistic. And then as you really start to look at what's going on, then sometimes you see, well, these are bad things that we're looking at.
It's funny because the work has evolved a bit in that direction, and I wasn't trying to do that. And it probably started a bit with the oil spill on the Gulf of Mexico, and people were even getting mad at me saying, why do you make an oil spill so horrible, something beautiful? And it definitely wasn't my intention, but I guess when you spend a lot of time there and you shoot tens of thousands of images, in the editing process is when I started to figure out that there were some images that were more appealing to me. No? And I find that it's interesting, especially with the most abstract images, there's a tension created when you don't understand very well what you're looking at. And through that process of interaction, especially with a print on a wall, when you're trying to see and gather exactly what it is, that really brings you to where I want to bring you, which is talk about the issue. You know? So sometimes it's interesting. In an art gallery, we have people walking by and entering and saying, oh, it's beautiful work. Who's the painter? They even think sometimes. And when they say, no, this is it, and they look at the caption, and it's an oil spill, and there's a physical reaction, and they separate from the print, and they backpedal almost, no, and it's just like, wow, that's horrible. But that's, you know, I want to create a reaction. I want people, maybe even that were not interested in to talk about those subjects, to be interested in them.
I agree, and this has actually been a discussion point that we've heard over the last couple days, which is, as photographers, as artists, we want to find ways to engage people and to create something that they will look at. And if it's just, and I'm not saying that horrific images are, you know, shouldn't be included at all, but if it's horrific at 20 feet, then you're probably not going to walk over there and really learn about what's happening. Whereas if you can get someone to come and take a look at and learn about whatever it is you're photographing, then you found a way to engage them.
I know you're completely right. And that doesn't mean that I'm downgrading the other type of photography. And I've done a lot of that, and I still do it. No, but in certain venues and with certain crowds, definitely this new approach works very well. No? And that's what I'm trying to do now.
And is that something that you're thinking about in, with Greenland also?
Well, definitely, if you look at the work I've produced already in Greenland, definitely it's absolutely stunning. It's horribly, stunningly beautiful. No, it's a big contradiction. But, you know, to me, going a bit back to the politics and where we're at, it's very interesting to hear that we're going to have a, an elected president that says that global warming doesn't exist. It's, to me, it's like if you say the Earth is flat. I mean, there's no way to argue this if you open your eyes and you look at all the world scientists working in these cases, and also what's happening. I always tell people, if you don't believe in this, just come one day with me and you'll see, because once you see it, it's impossible not to believe it.
And that's why this, I think this work is important, so people can see what's going on, and then, you know, they can decide for themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because my audience is, you know, made up of photographers, you know, I have to ask you this next question, which is, so what gear do you use? I mean, what are your favorite lenses, and you know, what type of camera bodies are you using right now that you really like for the work that you're doing?
It really depends on the projects, but I'm shooting with Nikon cameras now. I've been shooting with the A10 for a while. I can't wait to see what Nikon has on the sleeve, because it's been a while already. So, but it's a beautiful camera that creates incredible files, and I do very large prints with that. I tend to use prime lenses. I've used a lot of Zeiss Otus lenses that give a phenomenal quality corner to corner. You know? So that's mostly what I do, but depending also. Sometimes I do projects on the ground and I'm shooting with big telephotos, depending.
How do you feel about changing lenses in the field? I mean, are you worried about dust, or do you use multiple bodies? Or, you know, how do you, if you're shooting with primes, you're probably switching out every now and then.
I do change lenses, and that's a problem sometimes with dust. You need to be careful, especially in some of the environments where I work. But I tend to work with three bodies, and try to minimize the change of lenses. But as you're saying, especially with primes, there's no way around it. No.
There isn't. You're not going to do everything with an 85-1.8 or whatever. Hey, speaking of gear, that's kind of a nice segue. I didn't plan on this. So I was working with the guys at Mindshift Gear, and they're big fans of you. And they say, well, actually, Daniel had a lot to do with Mindshift Gear even being in existence. Is there a story there?
Oh, it's a funny story. I'm one of the co-founders of the company. I was a big fan of Think Tank Photo and a heavy user of their bags. And I was going on a trip to Brazil, I don't know, many years ago already. And I needed a roller bag. I had all kind of backpacks, but I wanted a roller bag because, you know, just the approach to where I was going is over 2 days flying, and with all the gear I'm carrying, I don't want to be carrying all that in the airport. So I wanted a roller, so I ordered one online directly from Think Tank Photo, and the bag arrived 2 days before my trip to Brazil. And when I opened the box, they had sent a backpack, not a roller bag. So I sent an email, you know, not so kind email, but not a mean email either. But I sent an email saying, hey guys, you know, I have 27 backpacks. What I need is a roller, which is what I order. And incredibly, 10 minutes later, the phone rang, and it was Doug Murdoch, who's the founder of Think Tank, or one of them, no? And he was super sweet on the phone, and he said, we messed it up. And I said, yes. He said, well, let me see how I can fix it. When are you leaving? And I was leaving the next day in the afternoon. So he said, I'll call you back. And he called me back 10 minutes later, and he said, FedEx has an overnight service. I can put a bag on your house, you know, by 7 in the morning. Will that work? And I thought, wow, these guys are incredible. No, they really care. And I wasn't expecting that at all. So it's funny how good customer service can completely turn around a bad experience, no? So we had a good conversation, and he said, you know, forget about the other bag. What I love to hear is what you think about this one, how it works, if you can send me a photo on the field. And so that started a relation, and I started to talk with them and help sometimes test some things, go for meetings in Santa Rosa. And I was always telling them, when are you going to do something for us outdoor nature photographers? Because, you know, this line of bags are great for the majority of photographers, but it's not so good for us working in the nature, no? And so, you know, they're square, rectangular, black. I wanted something different. So we started to talk about this, and, you know, time went by, and one day I got a call and said, hey, we're thinking about doing this. Why don't we talk? And this is how Mindshift started.
That is a cool story, actually. I know that sometimes the best customer service stories are the ones where things do start out going wrong and then they make it right, you know, as opposed to everything always being peaches and roses. So, you know, what was the thinking then? Did they want your field experience to say, hey, we want to design a bag that really works in places like the Amazon, places like that? Was that what they were after with you?
Well, you know, we know with think tank, Kurt and Deanne were involved also from the beginning as journalists giving feedback and with the company. So I think they wanted to do a bit the same with MindShift. They have somebody that had a strong foot all in conservation and was really interested in these things and doing field work and to get the feedback. No, and so definitely I've been involved in testing, in checking, in giving ideas. And but of course, you know, the big designers, it's them, it's not me. No, so I'll go and I play, I suggest things, and then they will do what they want. I'm happy to say that. Yeah.
Some things are best left in the hands of designers. Yes. Hey, okay, so that's good. I just have a couple more things I want to ask you about because, you know, photography is changing a lot in terms of how we interact with our audience. So I'm going to ask you about just a couple things. And the first one is video. How do you feel about video? Is video part of what you're doing? Are you staying away from video?
Well, I'm staying away from video because I don't know much about it. And I think it's very difficult to do both. And we just heard a beautiful presentation by Sandesh Karur, and he was saying that he does photo or video, but he cannot do both, and I feel the same. So for now, I've been just doing photography, but I had sometimes clients that say, you know, will you do both? And I say, no, I don't think the, I think the quality, I will lower the quality. It takes a lot of effort, to, at least to me, to produce decent images, and so I want to be concentrated on that.
Yes, and you know, that's another message that we heard today, that even if you are skilled at both, you just do one at a time. Just do one, no going back and forth. And plus the darn thing about video, there's two things about video, I have to say. One is you have to deal with the audio part of video. And then the other part is video editing is not nearly as fun for me as raw editing. I'd much rather edit a raw file than a video file. So, okay, let me ask you about another thing. How do you feel about social media? Let's say Instagram, or do you have any social media outlets that you like?
I what I use the most is Facebook and some Instagram. That's what we use the most. It's interesting to start developing an audience there. I'm not very good at it, but I definitely have a nice amount of followers on Facebook and people that are interested in what you have to say. I don't always do photography. It's funny. I get much more into issues and a lot of politics sometimes, or environmental stories, or human rights stories that personally interest me. I find photography to be almost a tool to cover and to highlight issues that I care about. No, and as much as I love photography, sometimes I joke saying I'm an activist with a camera. No, there's things that I care and I want to talk about, and that's, you know, I can express myself with images better than with words.
Thank you so much for taking time out. You know, we're here in Washington, D.C. right now. This is great being around these other photographers, and it's been a pleasure for me to get to know you a little bit better.
Well, same here. I really have been following what you do, and it's very, very interesting, and I hope, you know, your listeners are going to enjoy this. So thanks a lot.
I think we will. Thank you. On the second day, we closed with a keynote by Brian Skerry, titled Luminous Seas. And Brian's easily one of the best-known underwater photographers in the world. He has done many projects for National Geographic, and he really has a good message to share about what's happening beneath the surface of the ocean, a place that we don't see very often, you and I, and he can bring that to us. So in his keynote, he shared imagery and thoughts on his current work and the conservation priorities that he has and the approach that he takes to helping educate all of us about the vital importance of what's happening in the oceans and a look at the beauty and, you know, some of the things that we need to be concerned about too. So anyway, here's a segment from Brian's talk.
It all started for me, of course, when I was about 5 years old in my parents' backyard swimming pool in Boston, Massachusetts, where I was dreaming about swimming with sharks and whales. I was either dreaming about sharks and whales at that moment or peeing in the pool, but for the sake of this presentation, we'll say I was dreaming. I had to wait a few years until I was about 15 years old to actually become a certified scuba diver, but it did happen. Here we see my original sea card. This, of course, was taken, this photo, right after I broke up with the Beatles. And what's stunning, actually, is how little I've changed since I was 15 years old. It's really staggering. But anyway, but you know, it was about a year after I began scuba diving that I picked up a camera for the very first time and sort of had this epiphany where I had always known that I wanted to be an explorer of the sea, but now I understood how I would do it. I would do it with photography. It was the perfect marriage of of storytelling and exploration. So, you know, like most photographers, I guess, when I first began, I just wanted to produce beautiful images, photographs that meant something to me. And I learned that there was nothing quite like returning from some faraway place with an image that was special. So I spent countless hours underwater searching for those brief moments where everything comes together, gesture, and grace, and light, in order to create something magical, something that just might stir the reader's soul. But I also understood that storytelling was equally paramount. And as my career evolved, I searched for ocean stories that might inform or compel people to care, stories that just might make a difference. Often this meant looking at the darker side of what was happening in the ocean, things that might not be evident or apparent to most people. You know, unless you're diving under the waves on a regular basis, these things wouldn't be on your radar. This is a photo I made while working on a story about a place called the Phoenix Islands, sort of this very remote region of islands owned by the country of Kiribati out in the central South Pacific. And it took me about 6 days to get there by boat from Fiji. And I thought the story was going to be about this pristine, beautiful garden of coral that existed out in this place. But when I got there, all I saw was acres and acres of dead coral. It had suffered this amazingly bad thermal heating event, and it killed all the coral. So the story shifted from being a sort of a celebratory story about, you know, a magical place to a climate change story, a story about the damage that was being done in the ocean. But these are things that readers, I think, need to see, that the world has to understand. If we're going to create solutions, we have to first understand those problems. So over time, I came to realize that through my work, I was seeing a more complete picture of the ocean. You know, I was looking at both the celebratory and the problems and trying to see how everything was connected. I felt as almost on every story, I was peeling back another layer of mystery and adding another piece to this grand oceanic puzzle. I also learned that the most effective storytellers are resourceful in their approach, that we can use multiple perspectives to reach people, because you just never know what might grab someone's attention. You know, we can be overtly conservation photographers and show those sort of doom and gloom pictures, but sometimes it's the other images that draw them in. So for me, it's about spending time underwater, as much time as possible, to look for those moments that I can capture, that what might draw a reader in. Somebody wants to read the caption and then hopefully read the text and learn a little bit more. You know, Earth's oceans are vital to our very existence, and photographs can communicate this in the most powerful of ways. From a single image, we can be motivated, educated, entertained, and inspired, and that truly can make all the difference.
Sandesh Kadur is, well, he's one of the characters of the conference, that's for sure. He's a wildly talented photographer and videographer. And he also attended our podcasting class on Monday at National Geographic, which I thought was pretty cool. And that's where I first got to know him and then continued to interact with Sandesh throughout the conference. And, you know, what a terrific guy. His talk really is very interesting. It's very personal in the sense of, unlike a lot of the other speakers that we've heard from, you know, he isn't a scientist with multiple degrees and so forth. He's someone that fell in love with the great mountain ranges of India as a child and just has not been able to stay away from them and has become really a self-taught photographer and videographer, and has a great message to share through his work about the preservation of this area, its vitality, and the importance that it has for India and beyond. So I think it's kind of fun to listen to Sandesh. He he's been funded many times for many projects, including by National Geographic. He really knows what he's talking about and what he's doing, and he produces beautiful images. And he's just flat out enjoyable to listen to. So I'm going to turn the mic over to him right now.
I'm from the land of the tiger, India. Yeah. But I'm not going to show you any pictures of the big cats, especially after Steve's talk last evening. I don't want to embarrass myself. And this image has nothing to do with the talk, except for the fact that I want you to see it on the big screen. But apart from the big cats, my other love is the mountains. And the mountains is where my story begins. My story of despair, tiredness, and absolute lonesomeness up in the mountains. But this is also the place where I fell in love. I fell in love with this mountain range, the Western Ghats of India. It's a mountain range that stretches 1,600 kilometers along the southwestern coast of India. So instead of going to school, I used to go spend my time hiking up in the mountains, which of course did no good to my academics, and I very, very quickly had an academic nosedive. So I failed in high school and in everything else I did, so that's why I'm a photographer. That's why I'm here, in front of you. I had no other hope, because in India, you know, you fail high school, that's the end. It's like the end of the road for you. So my parents exiled me to the other side of the world, to Texas. So if I say y'all every now and then, you know where I got that from. But it also allowed me to speak a little bit of Spanish, so I can communicate with a lot of my Spanish friends here, which is great. So I think failing high school was one of the best things that happened in my life. So I came here, I started university through some kind of a loophole in the system, and I very quickly convinced my university, University of Texas, it was Texas Southmost College, a community college, accepted anybody. They didn't ask for my high school degree or diploma. So I got in and I convinced my university that they have to do a documentary about the Western Ghats. So very soon they sent me back to India with a video camera in my hand. And of course, I was back in India, much to my parents' dismay. But here, I was on an official university trip. So it was cool. They didn't know I'd actually dropped out of college. So that's my selfie of the Western Ghats. So this is the area that I fell in love with, and the area that didn't allow me to go to school, because it was an area that I just loved to explore. I mean, this mountain range of grasslands and rainforests, two of the most productive ecosystems on the planet, converging high up in what's called the Shola forests of the Western Ghats. In here, you have an incredible diversity of plant species, over 5,000 species of flowering plants just in this mountain range. I'm not much of a plant person, except I know that that's an impatience. And out of 100 species found in the Western Ghats, 90 of them are not found anywhere else on the planet. So there's a high rate of endemism, just like in Ecuador, in this little mountain range in southwestern India. And then you have species of Strobilanthus, the Kurunji, which flowers once every 12 years, and it is just extravagant. If any of you want to see the next flowering cycle, it's going to happen in 2018, coming up soon. So the entire mountain range is just purple with this beautiful flower. And anyone who likes honey, there's a beautiful honey that comes out during the season, the Kurunji honey, and it tastes just like the flower. It's delicious. And hidden in this incredible, vast, beautiful floral landscape are little critters like the jumping ant. Anyone heard of this guy? It's a Herpigmanthus species with a little appendage down in the center of its body that allows it to spring up into the air about 100 times its own size and catch things like grasshoppers, one of my favorite ant species. And you have lots of different species like cicadas, which have different cycles, 13-year cicada that emerges out of the ground and molts under the leaves of many of the rainforest plants. And out there in the canopy to eat cicadas are a wonderful group of birds. Over 580 species are found here, and many of them are endemic, like the gray hornbill, and they love feeding on cicadas. So it's an incredibly beautiful and complex set of animals found here. Beautiful birds like the Malabar trogon. And up in the canopy, you also have some really cool things. If it's not birds, if you're not into birds, but you don't want to look in the canopy, you might miss the black panther. So I, in my 39 years of existence, had never seen this animal. And if it wasn't for the karma that my good friends in the back seat, the Hootamans, brought to India, with them, I got to see this amazing Black Panther in the month of June earlier this year. So it's one of the rarest animals you'll photograph, one of the big cats. And they're up in the canopy going after monkeys. And many of the monkeys found in the Western Ghats are endemic, like the Nilgiri langur, the lion-tailed macaque. And these are not found anywhere else on Earth. And if it's not for the lion-tailed macaques, you also have pesky creatures like this bonnet macaque with a cool hairdo. And these monkeys have adapted to a life in the rainforest. It's a monsoon forest where it rains a lot. And all of this rainfall leads to an incredible diversity of reptiles. And sitting at the apex of the reptilian world is the king cobra, the largest venomous snake in the world, with enough venom apparently to kill an elephant. But it can also kill about 100 people at once. So not a snake to get close to, but it's an animal that I worked a lot with, and we did two documentaries, one for National Geographic called Secrets of the King Cobra, came out a few years ago, and one we just completed this year, which would be out on National Geographic and Smithsonian. There's also a great diversity of reptiles in terms of lizards, like this Grandis squamus, the large-scale forest lizard.
I'm going to wrap up the show with a few thoughts by Robin Moore, whom I taught with in the podcasting class on Monday, and who did a talk back from the brink, Frogs in Haiti. His blurb, or the talk that we're going to hear his closing remarks from, was about several scientific and photographic expeditions leading to new species discoveries and lost species rediscoveries have formed the basis of innovative outreach efforts to engage people in the conservation of Haiti's remaining forests and their unique wildlife. Robin talked about these initiatives, such as the Search for Lost Frogs and Frame of Mind, and a program he co-founded to empower Haitian youth to connect with their natural and cultural worlds through photography and storytelling. So that's what Robin was talking about, but I thought his closing remarks were perfect for bringing our show to a close here. I hope you've enjoyed this show, and I think I'm just going to let Robin take it from here, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye now.
And I put this slide before last week, actually, and it has a special poignancy now. I think that it's very easy to despair when we're working against the narrative of economic progress and growth, and we're up against very powerful forces. But I think it's very important that we find that hope, because I think an ounce of hope is worth a ton of despair. Despair is not a motivating force for people. If we make people despair, they get powerless, they get hopeless. And I think what Lovely and her friends have shown me in Haiti, that you can find hope in the most unlikely of places. And it's a case, I think, of finding it and really sort of holding on to that, and finding these shared values and painting a sort of joint picture of a more prosperous future that you can work together to try to achieve. So thank you.